Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek. Every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today in our constantly changing future. Now, Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, or dealing with addictions. As I'm sure many of you expected to hear Alan's voice today, we are reminded of the reality of what he does when he's not on the air. As a licensed private investigator and crisis interventionist, he gets calls and has to respond quickly, be it locating a runaway teen, escorting a teen to a specialized program, or retrieving an abducted child. Alan is out there all the time. And I talked with him this morning and learned that once again, he's been asked to locate a runaway teen that has been abducted, and she's in one of these prostitution rings. So, of course, I want to wish Alan success in rescuing this child, and hopefully we can get him back to the show safe and soon. As for today, I am very, very excited. We have our guest, John Kim, who's a licensed therapist, but he is not just a licensed therapist. He's so much more, and he's really kind of a revolutionary therapist, in my opinion. He's chose not to present himself in a typical psychologist way. He's a guy who will wear T-shirts and a jean, and he prefers a language of me too, as opposed to you should. John's blogs about his shortcomings, his revelations, his view on relationships, the self-help business, and the world. He's got a motorcycle, and he just started coaching and doing therapy in a very, very unconventional way. After a while, he built himself a full private practice. He would see clients all over the world using his phone, and he'd zoom around town in his motorcycle to do sessions at coffee shops. And through this process, John was able to come up with a lot of his own concepts. He realized that there was a new way for him to help others, combining what he learned in therapy school with life coaching and using technology to be mobile and create online communities. But most importantly, he took a very, very different approach, once frowned upon by the rigid and antiquated therapy world. He practiced transparency. Now, people kept asking him why he calls himself the angry therapist, and his reply is, it's his way of saying he's human. Well, we are so excited to have this pioneer in the therapy world on today, and his new book, entitled The Angry Therapist, A No BS Guide to Finding and Living Your Own Truth. John Kim, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Wow, that's like the best intro I think I've ever had so far.
Well, I'm excited.
So thorough.
I picked up your book a couple weeks ago and I read it through. And I can say I probably read three or four books in my life more than once. And then I read it again last weekend because as a therapist, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I felt like it was my thoughts as I was reading it. I mean, everything that you and I experienced in grad school, and you've taken it and you've formulated it in today's world, which is much different than the one we were taught in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that process of becoming a therapist is broken. You know, I think there's it just needs a shake up, and it's very old school. So we'll see what happens. It's kind of an exciting time, you know.
And what led to, was writing the book just kind of an idea that sprung from working with different people?
Yeah, it's, working with teenage addicts and residential and then online and just working with people in conventional ways. I try to simplify or just kind of put growth in a shot glass. I think there's a lot of fat in self-help. It could be very dense and complicated. I'm like your average John C. student, and in order for me to understand something, it has to be really simple. So I just put it in my language, and many resonate to that because it's simplifying stuff up in a way.
And the title of the book is The Angry Therapist. Where did that come about?
I went through a divorce about 7 years ago and left with nothing. I tell people I left with a pillow. It was a Tempur-Pedic pillow. She got the bed, and in my car. And my parents being Koreans, they wanted to buy me something to because they felt bad for me. So they bought me a laptop, and I took it, and I decided to create a blog. I called it The Angry Therapist. I didn't put any thought into it. I thought it was kind of funny. I was definitely an angry person growing up, you know, in my 20s, 30s, just angry because I wasn't happy. I was very lost and directionless. And I decided to pull the curtain back and just be myself and be super transparent. And I just kind of like started documenting my journey and as I became a therapist and as I was helping other people and my revelations. And it kind of it took off. And I think people resonated to this guy, just, you know, jeans, t-shirt, like you were saying, just riding his motorcycle, meeting people in parks and coffee shops and talking about his quote unquote fucking feelings, you know?
To me, there's a quote, like being real, you know, like a realness to you and your approach. But this is different than traditional therapy and, you know, this idea of transparency. Did that come about because you had a lot of success in kind of just being who you were, is this something that can be replicated? Or talk to me a little about that and what's your idea of transparency?
Yeah. I think that when you go through the clinical route, you're kind of taught to be very neutral and, you know, you're not supposed to disclose a lot about yourself and all that, which I get because it's all about the client. But I think that when you are, transparent and you are showing yourself, and not to make it about you, but, you know, kind of showing people who you are, it produces glue, it produces trust, it produces that relatability factor. And I just learned through my experimenting as a therapist slash life coach that is kind of soil, you know, that's the foundation. And I think that it's so important when working with people to build that trust and for them to be able to relate to you. And the only way to do that is just to be authentic and be you and, you know, share your story a little bit.
You know, to me, it puts you at a more vulnerable place and a more real, you know, authentic place, which I think a lot of people can relate to. The book itself, and I don't, you know, I want everyone to go out there and buy it, and I don't want to ruin it, but there's a lot of things that when I was reading it, kind of my ears kind of, you know, popped up. And I do want to go into some of those things. And one of the things you said in the book, which I thought was fascinating, is that our purpose in life is not to be happy, but it's to be useful. And when I think about our current society, where there's learned optimism, and every self-help book is about happiness. Your book is completely, to me, a wonderful self-help book, and we'll get into that. But it's not, the focus is not on being happy in life.
Yeah, I think happy is there's like a mirage factor that happy is just generic, and it's one of those words that we glamorize and we chase. I think, you know, to be quote unquote happy, you have to be fulfilled. If you don't feel fulfilled and whole, having a sense of, you know, value, then it's very hard to be happy. I've learned that, you know, things and things outside of self, like objects and seeking approval, validation, none of that leads to happiness. In my 20s, I was chasing shiny things. It wasn't until I became a therapist and started helping others where I found fulfillment, found value, and that leads to a happy state.
And when you're reading, I mean, you know, when I'm looking at Martin Seligman and he's writing, you know, Learn Optimism, and a lot of these focuses are on happiness. For me, it's similar to you. I almost feel like it's a phrase that, you know, it's so subjective in nature. And I think that's part of the issue with our field is everything is so subjective. But to have purpose and meaning in your life, which you talk about, it leads right into my favorite quote of the book. And it's in you know, to paraphrase it, it's discussing on what our focus should be on is how we're remembered versus how we're perceived. And you go in the book and say that, you know, we're so focused on how we're perceived, you know, and then in that sense, all we're looking for is validation. Whereas, you know, by being more focused on how we'll be remembered, it's a completely different way of approaching life.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I talk a lot about giving and taking and turning your dials. And I think that, you know, just because we're nice, it doesn't mean that we're giving. When we are seeking something from someone else, that's conditional. So if it's validation or approval or membership or something, even though what we may be doing is nice, we are actually taking because we want something from the other person. truly giving is about not wanting anything, but you know, offering your gifts and living a very through me life. So you're helping people, but not wanting anything really back. That makes sense.
Yeah, but to me it seems like such a hard mountain to climb, you know, when I'm working with patients. It feels like to me we almost have this human nature for validation, and to get to the point it's almost like to get to the point you're talking about, that's a pretty steep hill to have people get to.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, I struggle with it too. I'm 43, and I think it's one of those lifetime journeys. I don't think it's something that you know, comes early. I think it comes with a lot of turbulence in life and going through, you know, expired relationships and revelations. And, you know, I think there's a difference between living a for me or a to me life and a through me life. And I think that difference is, you know, the between giving and taking. A lot of people live a very to me life. They live very victim mode, big ego. It's not until later in life where you start to have less ego and you start to live a through life. So it's almost like you're a vessel or a messenger, and the powers bigger than you are working through you to you know, reach and reach with those.
John, we're experiencing a minor technical issue. We're going to call you right back. This is Dr. Matt Polacek, co-host of Answers for the Family. We are experiencing a minor technicality, and we'll be right back.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
Welcome back to Answers with the Family. We are here with John Kim, author of The Angry Therapist. And John, sorry, you got cut off a little bit there.
Yeah, no worries. What part got cut off?
We were discussing the for me and the kind of transferring the way, you know, we look at things being perceived as, you know.
Yeah, being remembered. Yeah, I think there's different mindsets. And I think there's, you know, like the to me and the for me and the by me, those type of mindsets, where there's big ego and a lot of taking. And I think the through me mindset is when you are more like a vessel or a messenger, and you're allowing powers greater than yourself to work through you to really give and to reach people. And I think in that state, you feel the most fulfilled. You know, it's almost like when you don't make it about you is when, you know, the universe does, kind of thing.
Yeah, but it seems like our culture is all about me and getting likes and all that. So it's like
absolutely
going against the current.
And that's why it's so hard.
And so we've got this culture that, you know, is preaching really the opposite of what's the most helpful for us or healthy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and you know, I struggle with that too. I think it's advertising, it's culture, it's media, and you know, since kids we've been exposed to it, so it's a lot of conditioning. And then there's, you know, social pressures in high school and all of that stuff. So it's something that you can't avoid. It's around you constantly, and I just know that it's a powerless type of living if you allow it to have power over you.
Yeah,
you know, billboards, advertising, all that.
Versus taking, being more empowered and being in more control. You know, kind of continuing on that light, you know, the book talks a lot about how, you know, when we judge other people, it actually increases our anxiety. But to me, and I agree with that, but it's almost like a human nature to, like, judge other people, even though it's a negative and it doesn't help. How do you see it as, you know, increasing anxiety when we constantly judge other people or compare ourselves to others?
I think whenever we're trying to trace a blueprint or we're comparing, you know, there's an evaluation process, and rarely do we compare and think that that we're better or prettier or smarter. You know, it's usually the other way, where we always feel less than, because we don't compare ourselves to people that have less than us, or that are less attractive, or that are less successful. We're always comparing ourselves to people that, you know, we believe have more. So it's like we fall into this slippery well of just constantly feeling less than, you know.
It's amazing you say that. I was reading a study by the Girl Scouts of America this morning, and that it was saying just that, that, you know, I think it was 8 out of 10 Girl Scouts feel that based on reading fashion magazines, they wish they were skinnier. And I think it was 35% of them admitted to starving or refusing to eat in order to get that way.
Yeah. And I've worked in many eating disorder clinics and run groups for women who have eating disorders. And yeah, I mean, it's real. It's, it becomes a disease, you know, an obsession. And it's, and especially with social media and Instagram and also filtered photographs, it's just creating a fantasy world that we're striving for that is very empty. That's a cul-de-sac, you know. It doesn't lead to anything other than evaluating ourselves and bashing ourselves.
This is interesting. As you're speaking, Claire from San Diego writes in, which is exactly what we're talking about. I'm constantly wanting to understand human behavior, and I'm concerned that our world, we're so obsessed with people like the Kardashians, who are basically operating off the id. We have another psychologist, it looks like, at all times. Why do I feel anger towards these celebrities, and why am I also so drawn to them? Thank you, Claire, by the way. Oh, no, I was just thanking Claire for writing us in here. I appreciate it. Go ahead, John. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's a great point. I think that we all have a pseudo side and a solid side. And I think that, you know, whatever we feel that we are lacking, we seek in others. So when you have, you know, the Kardashians, there's something about her or her life or what she has or what she represents or that idea that I think a lot of people are attracted to, because they don't, you know, they're trying to fill holes in themselves. So if they can't be that person, they're going to want to, you know, watch that person or be around that person or, you know, gravitate toward that person in their life in a certain way. And I think that's why she has, you know, such a huge following.
That's amazing. So it's almost like what we're seeking is the opposite of what this book is teaching us. You know, we're seeking, again, external things, items, right, versus being a useful human being.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the... that's our natural default, and that's not our go-to. That's our natural. We have to actually be aware of it and go against that to hit a higher potential.
And so
I think what happens is we turn invisible. So whenever we're seeking, whenever we're comparing, whenever we feel less than, and the more that we do it, and the more that we try to fulfill, you know, our holes with, you know, other people, then we become invisible and grayed out. You know, I think that going the other way is what makes you very potent and living higher at your potential, unique and different, and, you know.
And do you find yourself, the more you practice this, comparing yourself less to others? I mean, have you noticed a reduction personally with you know, kind of trying to attain this?
Yeah, and for me, the tipping point was, it's like I've had two lives. I used to be in entertainment as a screenwriter, and I ran a restaurant bar in Hollywood that was very scenic for a while. So I lived in my 20s and 30s, I lived a very approval-seeking, exchanging my truth for membership, you know, wanting to be one of the cool kids. Like, I lived all that, and I was very invisible. You know, I was kind of like a leaf floating around in the world. And it wasn't until I lost everything, started all over, and after the divorce, started being a therapist, where I decided that I'm not going to seek anymore, but I'm just going to be me, be authentic, be transparent, show the world who I am, let my voice be heard, and let's see what happens. And what happened was I found purpose. What happened was, you know, I built a team. I created a movement. Like all this stuff happened organically just because of that one shift of thinking different.
So this divorce really was a turning point in your life, and you took something that for most people, you know, can be catastrophic, destructive, all the above, and you really it sounds like you really grew out of it.
I did, and you know, it's like Steve Jobs says, you can't connect dots until you're looking back. And at the time, it, you know, it was crazy, it was painful, it was lonely, it was miserable and all that. But looking back, it was probably the best thing that's ever happened to me. It was the catalyst to my rebirth and, you know, pulling more from my solid self instead of pseudo.
You also in the book talk about a container. For those out there who wouldn't understand that concept, will you elaborate on that a little?
Yeah, you know, I use a lot of my own language, my own verbiage, and I don't do it for the sake of it. It's just how I speak and how I see the world. And the container concept is, you know, I believe that we all have the our own containers. It's kind of like our life space. And I believe that most people have cracked containers. That's due to their, you know, the trauma or past relationships or faulty thinking. And whenever there's cracks in your container, it stunts your growth. So, for example, if you are in an abusive relationship where you're getting punched in the face, that's a very cracked container that's going to stunt your growth. I believe that we can build brand new containers for ourselves. And I believe that when you do, that growth becomes organic. You know, we're evolving creatures. We're curious. We're not like stagnant in that way. So as long as you create a safe space, a safe life space for you, and that's what my book's about, how to do that, growth is exponential and growth happens. So it's just the idea that all you have to do then at that point is just live different.
Was the intention of The Angry Therapist to be a self-help book? Because as I read it, I felt personally like it, I mean, it definitely helped me. And I felt as I was reading it, you know, there's so many specific points in there and ideas of how to live your life that it felt like it was, I call it a backdoor self-help book in the sense where it wasn't advertised as a quote self-help book per se, but it was a true self-help book, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's almost like my book is almost like a mini version of my 7-year long blogging journey, kind of taking the highlights and what I've learned and putting it, you know, into a like what I call a shot glass. I didn't set out to, even when I got the book deal, I just kind of fell in my, I never set out to do that. It wasn't until recently that I even considered myself a writer, which is kind of funny. That's a compliment. Is I think if you set out to write a self-help book, you're putting a lot of pressure on yourself. If you set out to tell the story and things that you've learned, it kind of becomes the backdoor self-help book in disguise, you know. And I think that's great.
And we have we're getting a lot of therapists today. We have Aaron, who I think is a therapist, writing in from Kansas City, that said, "How refreshing to read about your approach to dealing with clients. I'm a therapist who burned out a couple years ago to travel and regroup. Rather than change professions, maybe your example is one I need to consider. Maybe I just need to change the way I go about it. I am very much to looking forward to reading your book. And I do have one question. What is your thoughts on the nature versus nurture debate?"
Well, first, let's talk about the whole,
regroup.
So what was interesting is when I was on my way to becoming a therapist, I lived two lives. So my one life was working in the clinical settings, you know, the shirt and tie, the residential, just being a very quote unquote therapist, doing, offices and stuff like that. And then when I came home and I was blogging, So in the clinical world, I felt like I was pushing a mail cart. I felt like Clark Kent. And then when I came home and I was blogging and I was John Kim, I was very myself, I felt like Superman. And so I listened to that, the feeling of wearing a cape because you are just being you and this is how you believe you can help people. And that led to, doing things that as a therapist, you're not supposed to. Like, for example, the webcam, you're only supposed to, in California, you're only supposed to see people in your own state, and I was getting people all over the world, and I didn't want to, so then I just put the hat on as a life coach, and I decided to help them because with the internet comes, you know, such wide reach. And then meeting people like on walks and hikes and stuff like that. Most therapists don't do stuff like that. I decided to play around in that space, and I think that's where you have the greatest connection and less burnout, you know, because now you're doing things that are honest to you and you're working in ways that are just exciting and different. And, you're not sitting in a room, you know, with someone on the couch hour after hour after hour, you know.
And you feel probably a lot more present, right? I mean, you feel a lot more present in these sessions that, you know, because they're a lot more authentic.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, if we're going to talk about life, let's do life while we're talking.
Yeah.
You know?
And so maybe this therapist, that is something to consider, is to alter their practice.
Sure. And sure. And I think that, and I don't know if you can relate to this, when we, you know, go through the clinical route, we're kind of trained and programmed to not do that. So if we start doing something like that, we feel maybe guilty, or we're doing something wrong, or there's, you know, there's fear. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and it's, again, the nature of our field is so subjective that we're all taught specific ways. And when I'm reading the book, I read a lot of kind of CBT intervention stuff that I was trained with. Mm-hmm. But I think at the end of the day, the connection is so important. And I think that young therapists absolutely. Are so worried about being, quote, good therapists that they don't pay attention to that part of it.
Yeah, you actually hit the nail on the head. It all starts with connection. But, you know, any relationship starts with connection, and especially when you're working with someone about their life and they're trusting you with their story. Without the connection, you have nothing. Then you're just someone who's giving a lecture, you know?
Yeah, hard to get anywhere there. And then what's your take what's your take on the nature nurture question from Aaron?
In what way?
It's a good question. I don't know. He basically at the end of the email said, I need to change the way I go about it. I'm very much looking forward to reading your book. And one question, what's your thoughts on nature? That's pretty general, actually.
Yeah, I think, and you know, I was trying to bring it back to my story and how I can relate to it. I think that our upbringing, I think that our, you know, our own containers, our family space, how we were raised, all the shit that's happened to us in the past, I think it forms us. I mean, I think it wires us a certain way, creates false beliefs and all that. You know, my parents didn't create they did the best they can, they could. They didn't create a lot of space for me to express my feelings or, you know, a lot of my love yous. Part of that is cultural, just being kind of Korean, old school. And I think that, you know, stuff like that as I grew up affected me. I think stuff like that is came out in who I was. The good news, though, is that you could be aware of that and start to rewire yourself and change. You know, that's why it's like my 20s and 30s, I was a completely different person than I am now at 43. And it was because I kind of made that transition. So, yeah, I think nature plays a huge part. I mean, nurture, your family upbringing and relationships and how you're raised creates a huge part in the early stages of just how you're going to do with relationships in life, you know?
I almost, you know, as you say that, I agree, but I also see it's you being open and being willing to change and to grow, whereas I see where other people it might confirm like validate them acting a certain way or being a certain way, and then, you know, then their, you know, return would be lack of growth. So it's almost a willingness. Right. You know, I agree. I mean, I think that our early childhood experiences obviously play such a big role. And I look at like the ACE study that Kaiser did, where we see that, you know, traumatic events or, you know, specific events in early childhood later on could actually have physical implications. And it seems like, you know, our upbringing can play such a role, but it can play if we don't grow, you know, even though we're physically, our brains are growing through our mid-20s and all that, we know, and we can change and grow and all that, and nature has a wonderful impact. But if we're not willing to, it can also further whatever pathology we have.
Yeah, absolutely.
When the
I think that's why a lot of us start turning the corner, you know, 30s, mid-30s. It's not until around then where you actually have the tools to be aware. You know, I think a lot of our 20s is just a residue of how we were brought up and a lot of reactions. You know, we don't start responding until later in life.
It's amazing, and to have the patience, I guess, with people you work with or children that you have. You know, to know, I mean, I completely 100% agree with you. Where I'm at now and where I'm at 20 years ago are two different places. And yeah. I even when I was, you know, a teenager, I noticed when I was 15, you know, 17 to 15 or 19 to 17, I couldn't believe the way I thought or acted compared to, as you know, we evolve as people. And I feel like for parents, sometimes it's hard to hang on and wait, because, you know, you just like me, I was in a adolescent substance abuse residential center just like you, and if we saw these kids 5 years later, 7 years later, it's a total different presentation.
Yeah, absolutely. And which is, you know, the beauty of being human is that people can have transformation, people can change. You know, it's great. It's inspiring to see people be very different than who they were before, you know.
Do you think that the people do believe that, though, as our culture believes that we can change? Or do you think you and I are just optimists?
Well, you know what's tough is secondary change, change that's not reversible. I think that a lot of people, it's like yo-yo dieting. I think they change kind of on the surface, or their behavior changes, and then, you know, then something happens and they snap back to kind of who they used to be. I think this idea of really changing from the inside out and being different, it takes time and it's rare. Like I think you're right. I think a lot of people, especially with self-help, it's like something they read about. They go to seminars. They kind of digest it as information, but they don't really change. They don't do the work. They don't do the other half of the coin, which is execution. You know, action steps.
Yeah, in the book, I know it talks about that. The other thing it says about change in the book is you say that everything starts with how you feel, and it's the birthplace of change. What did you?
I think just working with clients and also just being in relationships with different people who grew up without that space of expressing themselves, and so like they basically internalize and they keep it all inside, and you know then they cope with the vices, whatever that may be, and that's just kind of the progress of us being in this world. And I think that unless you're able to finally express yourself, because when you're expressing yourself, you're telling yourself you exist, that growth is impossible. Like if you don't express your state and how you feel and you're not honest with yourself, it's so slippery. There's nothing to build on.
When I was reading the book, I think about thoughts and feelings, and I think of, along the lines of, cognitive behavioral therapy and having kind of maladaptive thoughts and having thoughts. Feelings are kind of what they are, and you can't help them, but some thoughts are wrong. They're illogical,
yeah.
Or they're
right.
Where are you with that, with working with people? Because I feel like, it's weird to sit across from someone and basically tell them that their thoughts are wrong.
Yeah, it's because of our cognitive distortions. It's because, there's that famous saying that we don't, we see the world as we are, not as it is.
Yeah.
And it's so true. I think that most of us, and we have about 60,000 thoughts a day, most of those thoughts are negative, they're worrying, they're dread, or they're, about the past or things that you could have, or they're comparing or judgment. And so it's like, all that stuff is what I think pushes us down and also disconnects us from feeling, and also behind negative thoughts or behind thoughts where we feel less than or defective, there's going to be negative feelings attached to that. So it's that cycle of just unhealthy thinking that I think is so common. And if you could break that cycle, it just changes everything.
And hearing you talk, for me, the first response I feel is, so the key really is just being present, being in the now. What's in front of you is what's in front of you almost. Is that fair?
That's fair. And that's very, that's kind of the big flag that wellness is waving today. But it sounds simple, but it's not. And I'm saying that from my own experience, even now today, even though I feel like I have some tools to control my thoughts and be present, it's a fight, it's a practice. It's something that you have to work at daily and take it in as a lifestyle, not just something that you do once in a while.
It'll be fascinating the more you and I kind of get our voices out there and communities to work on these things long term. What kind of impact can we have if we raise young adults and people in a world where they're kind of working on like what you would call a solid self, I guess. A solid self. That's a good transition. Tell us a little about what the concept of solid self.
It's the truth. It's you. It's who you are. I always compare it to, there's a movie called Fight Club, one of my favorite movies, and Edward Norton, there's a spoiler alert, just FYI, but Edward Norton, Brad Pitt, the movie is about inner conflict. It's one person, and Edward Norton is very pseudo in the beginning because he's lost and has insomnia. He's buying IKEA furniture and whatever, and then he meets Brad Pitt, which is his solid self. And because he starts listening to that side, he becomes a leader, you know, he finds a movement, he falls in love, and he actually finds his voice and empowerment and all that. So I think that's, it's just a great metaphor for how we are, is that we have that solid self. And the solid self is usually the quiet voice. It's the one that we, you know, it's the whisper that we never listen to. And then we have our pseudo self, and that's the side that's, you know, liking all of Kim Kardashian's posts and spending money on name brands and consumerism and advertising and all that. And I think our pseudo self is the most powerful side, and we have to eclipse that, and it takes time, by pulling from our solid instead of our pseudo. And I also think that it's, you know, no one's 100% solid. Like, I mean, you know, it's just Jesus or Buddha, or, I mean, you know, everyone has that inner conflict constantly. And it depends where you're at. You know, you may be very solid with your kids. You may be very you and authentic and not seeking anything, and being very present. But then at work, you may be very pseudo, you know. So I think throughout your day, think about where you're solid, where you're pseudo, and why. And then the work would be to try to pull from your solid self, see what happens. And, you know, you may surprise yourself that, oh, nothing bad happened. Or I spoke out today and I got compliments. And then it's giving yourself those experiences where you start leaning more into your solid, because, you know, experiences are very convincing. And then you start to believe something different.
Would you recommend people actually write down, their meaning and value of what the solid self would look like versus the pseudo self? Would that be a helpful exercise?
Sure. I think that'd be great, yeah, to actually write down and to see that person and how that person thinks and what he or she likes and what he or she deserves and all, and to create like a three-dimensional person, I think would be really helpful, absolutely.
You know, one of the things that, I heard you describe yourself as is a lifestyle designer. Is this kind of play into that, helping people create this world, or where did the lifestyle designer come from?
Yeah, I just I don't like the word therapy. I don't like, because I think there's, you know, there's judgment behind it. Life coach is an interesting word, but I like this idea of let's redesign your life. You know, I think that things are built and we can rebuild or redesign their life, and to me that makes more sense. And so I just I don't know if I came up with it or if someone called me that one day and I liked it. Is that I'm a life designer.
For people listening, you know, and you being their life designer, where would, besides obviously getting the book, what are some things that people listening in could do right away to start this process?
Just going back to your solid and pseudo, I think the first thing you can do is, you know, nothing is built without truth, and that means not only being honest with others but yourself. So knowing when you're solid and seeking approval, validation, membership, that's pseudo. Knowing when you're pseudo, knowing when you're solid, and knowing why, and just making a decision to, you know, ask yourself, what would it look like to be solid? What would that look like in action? How would I be in relationships? How would I treat my husband, my wife, my kids if I was more solid? And then leaning into that and actually giving yourself new experiences in that way, you know?
It seems like a lot of this stuff is assessment-based and taking the time to ask yourself questions about how you want to live your life and how you're living your life in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think we don't ask ourselves those questions.
No.
We are too busy worrying about taxes and paychecks and the grocery list.
It's amazing. My company, you know, I'm the director at the Betty Ford Center and here in West LA. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we do is a concept called rounding, where we ask our staff members, you know, what's working, what's not working. And I asked my wife the other day, I came home and I said to her, you know, so what's working well in our relationship or our marriage? And she gave me a look like, you know, she was so shocked that I asked that question.
Yeah.
And it's true.
Yeah.
We don't do enough assessment of ourselves, the relationships we're in, and how can we improve and get better if we're not, you know, there's no accountability and no assessment.
Yeah. And I applaud you for asking your wife that. I think that's great. I think that's what, you know, building relationships look like.
Well, and, I phrased it in a way, I could only get a positive answer. I said, what's working well?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, but maybe you did that purposely. Maybe you wanted to keep it positive and not, you know, what's not working and go down that whole road.
Yeah, there's ways of phrasing questions that end up with a nice answer, right?
Yeah, but listen, I don't think, I mean, as long as your intention's good, I think that's great. I think that angle, you know, works. you know, what's positive in our relationship. And then as you have that conversation, you maybe will be reminded on how valuable, or, you know, how far you guys have come or what you've built. I think it's great.
And as far as doing, you know, setting this to practice in your life with your patients, have you noticed a difference in, because you really shifted from being more of a, you know, in the office traditional therapist to an online practice and, you know, outside the walls of the, you know, the rooms. Have you noticed it been more beneficial, less beneficial, the same, any differences?
So when I first started, there were still people on dial up, and the webcam was very, it looked like people were breakdancing because it would, you know, freeze and then move and freeze and move. But now, I mean, you can literally just get on the phone, and it's the quality is so amazing now that, you could see a teardrop, you know? And so I think, you know, that being said, there's nothing better than in person. I mean, in person, because that's, you know, that's the ultimate, you know, you can't get more accurate than that. But I think that because of technology and webcams and everything, you can now be a conduit into anyone's home anywhere around the world, which is like, who wouldn't take advantage of that? So like your reach has just, you know, there's no roof. It's like, you can reach anyone at any time. And I think that is such a powerful tool that, how can we not use that to help people, you know?
And for you, it'll be fascinating because, you know, you're, aside from a psychologist, therapist, coach, thinker, writer, I'm interested to, you know, to talk with you in a couple of years and notice if you start noticing themes in certain areas or in different cultures, because you've opened up your walls now to work with people really all over the world, and that'll be fascinating to me to see if, you know, what solid self looks like in our country versus other countries. Do you predict individuals culture versus collectivist cultures, you predict a lot of differences in the people you work with, or is kind of human's plight?
I do. I think that it's a really good time for this whole being solid or a better version of yourself or living at higher potential, because, you know, wellness has kind of become commercialized now. I think wellness, you know, back in the day, you only saw your therapist if you were quote unquote crazy, or, you know, like with our parents, it was kind of embarrassing or shameful. Now it's a luxury, and now everyone has a life coach, and now, you know, yoga, meditation, and some of the stuff we're talking about, being present, it's so mainstream now that, I think it's breaking a lot of cultural barriers.
And for you, what's, you know, you got The Angry Therapist out now, and I assume it's on Amazon and all the major, online shops. What's next for you?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It comes out April 17th.
So it's not out?
Yeah, no. You could get a pre-order now, but it's not out for about a month.
Oh, so I got lucky, didn't I?
Yeah, I mean, sure. I mean, I got lucky. I got lucky that you have me on before my book comes out. But what's next for me is I want to hopefully use the book as a ticket into doing some speaking gigs, just getting out there and just spreading my message and sharing my story. You know, shows and the stuff that I'm doing, like today, and just keep talking and creating a dialogue about this stuff, you know.
And you had mentioned you're building a team.
Yeah, we have a startup called Shift, and we have a team. We have developers, and it's an online platform where we're changing lives through this idea of tribes. So the other big belief I have is that we're not meant to do life alone. And I found the power of that in working in residential treatment. And, you know, you're at Betty Ford, so I'm sure you see it too, group work. And so we have these tribes, and basically you could go through whatever topic, whether it's divorce, recovery, or addiction, or anything, all through your phone for a certain amount of time, led by a life coach or a therapist. And we call them tribes. And it's kind of like that movie Breakfast Club, where there's, you know, all these strangers that come in because of a common theme, and then they leave super close and changed. And we're able to do that online. So they're like virtual support groups called tribes.
What a beautiful concept. You know, for me, I worked in residential and adolescent residential and Betty Ford. I was a private practice therapist, similar to you. And that was one of the things that I noticed is with addiction and with other things, one-on-one is helpful, but there's something magical about the group. You know, there's something that
absolutely.
A group can do.
There's power in it.
It's amazing. And it's, to me, it's, you know, someone once, I was having an argument with someone that was discussing like addiction and saying, well, now they just go to like AA and aren't they addicted to AA? And my feeling was, you know, I felt that if you're, you know, pro-dependent or interdependent on people, that's not such a bad thing in this world, is to be able to lean on others.
That's what it's about.
right. You know, that's living.
That's why we're human. So, yeah, we're not meant to do life alone. And I think that we need to get back to that. So I think the power of community is huge, especially in addiction and other areas where we feel so alone, you know.
And for those listening out there, aside from April, when's the book come out?
The book comes out in April, early April. And and that's it.
Yeah. Well, anything, any final thoughts or advice for people out there that aren't going to be able to read the book for the next few weeks to kind of start them off in their journey here?
Yeah. Come over to Shift. We also have a life coaching course. We have communities. We have a lot of free stuff. Just come to Shift, shft.us, not .com. And you can find, you know, everything that I'm doing, what I'm doing. Or you can just go to theangrytherapist.com and see all my stuff there. But, you know, there's funnels that'll bring you into our community and you know, we'll give you something that you want or that you may need or that you may want to work on and all different ways to do it.
John, it was such a pleasure. I was looking forward to meeting you, and I love the book, and I'm very thankful that you were able to come on the show.
No, thank you so much. Yeah, and if I get a chance, I'd love to come visit you at the Betty Ports, and I love what you guys are doing over there.
I would love it. We'll see you soon then. And come on again show when you write your next book.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thanks so much. And for all you listeners out there, please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday, March 13th. We've got Give It a Go, Eat a Rainbow. Our guest is Catherine Goulet. She credits her family for her continued passion for nutrition and healthy living. And if you missed or you want to share our show with your friends, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com. You may also subscribe or resubmit your name to download your free copy of the Attitude of Gratitude Journal, your 21-day guide to achieving the quality of thankfulness through self-discovery. And the next time you're on Facebook and Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and check out some of our latest posts. And if you like them, please like us and spread the word. Hopefully, Alan will be back next week. I'm looking forward to him. We want to thank John Kim again for being with us. And for all you out there, have a great and wonderful day. And thanks for listening to Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.